Shalom, good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Sandra.
Shalom to you, Jane.
Well, I'm delighted to have in the studio today Sandra Van Eden. And I'm going to be nosy and ask her about her family. So, you know, it's always fascinating to know which countries people come from, how their parents met, and what motivated them to actually come to New Zealand.
Well.
So you'll go back to your grandparents.
Go back to my grandparents. So my grandparents were both born in Vienna, and their fathers were watch repairers and went to the same synagogue, lived in the same area, and so knew each other, and that's how my grandmother and grandfather met when they were little children. My grandmother used to play with my grandfather's little brother. And
so the families knew each other.
They knew each other, yep. And my mother was born in Vienna on the 31st of March 1931, 8 years before the Anschluss. And in the first week of the Anschluss, the Nazis came into the flat. My mother remembers the soldiers' boots kicking open doors and the soldiers taking away whatever they wanted. And most people in those days, of course, lived in multi-generational family homes. And the soldiers took away her father and both her grandfathers because they lived in one home together with both sets of grandparents. And they were held prisoner. Now, this was before World War II. This was before the terrible concentration camps, but they were locked up in a prison somewhere because they were Jewish, and the women were left in the house supposedly to starve to death, but non-Jewish friends and neighbours, you know, Christians who lived around them, brought them food. And there's another whole story about how my grandfather and my great-grandfathers managed to escape, that's a whole story in itself. But they managed to escape, and they said to everybody in the synagogue, we have to get out, we have to go, because my grandfather was a great student of history. He, being Jewish, he wasn't allowed to go to university, so he decided to educate himself about the world, and he read everything he could get hold of. And he had a book, which I still own, called Hochstetter's Neuseeland, and his dream was to get out of Austria and get to New Zealand. Well, they managed to get out via the underground movement, who took them to Britain. And in Britain, they applied for visas to every country in the world which would take Jews. And, of course, New Zealand wouldn't take Jews. Mm. And they were living on a farm which some Quakers were running and looking after refugees from Europe. Even though World War II hadn't started yet, there were a lot of refugees streaming out of Europe. And the idea was you worked on the farm and you were fed and looked after. And there was a big house on the farm, and you also had to work in the big house, in the kitchen, at the table, doing laundry. And one night my grandfather was waiting on the table, and the visitor to dinner that night was an archbishop in the Anglican Church. And he thought he would just talk to this Jewish refugee, just let him practice his English, get to know his story a little bit. And he was really impressed by my grandfather. And when he heard that my grandfather's dream was to go to New Zealand, but New Zealand wouldn't accept Jews, he wrote a letter to somebody he went to school with in New Zealand, which was a New Zealander he went to school with in Britain. Mm. And that New Zealander was Arnold Nordmeyer, who then was the deputy leader of the Labour Party, and said, look, I've just met this really nice man. Him and his family would love to go to New Zealand. Can you get them some visas? So I can't remember the very small number of visas that was given to Jews during World War II, but our family got six of them.
good.
And that's how we came to New Zealand. Of course, today it's a crime called nepotism, but that's how things were done in the 1930s. And so my...
It always is who you know, yeah. Even today.
Well, it wasn't even someone my grandfather knew. Mm. He waited on the table, you know, at the table. And the
you need an advocate.
Yes, you do, yeah. And
so your grandparents?
My grandparents... And both sets of great-grandparents, and my mother left Vienna, but one great-grandmother passed away in England while they were waiting to get visas. So six of them arrived in New Zealand.
And they came by ship in those days?
They came by ship during World War II, which, you know...
The war had already broken out.
War broke out while they were on the way, yeah.
Well, they were in the way from Britain to to New Zealand. Wow, so you had U-boats then and...
Yep. Mm. So, in fact, the family settled very close to where we're speaking here in Mount Albert.
So they came to Auckland.
They came to Auckland and they rented a house in Mount Albert, which was pulled down when they built the rocket for Rocket Park. So
you had an intergenerational home.
Yes. I'm the first person in the history of both my father's family in Holland and my mother's family in Austria to be born and grow up in a nuclear family.
Mm. So your father's family then came from Holland.
Well, they're all in Holland. Just my dad came and one of his brothers.
So they came... Just as new migrants, not for any getting away or from danger or...
Well, my father didn't enjoy the Kleinseligkeit, the small-mindedness of Holland. You know, he was brought up in a small village with very strict rules and everybody knew what everybody else was doing and he couldn't wait to get out. He travelled quite a bit as a young man. He was the first person in the history of his family to go to high school. And then he went on to university and in Holland. And as the son of a windmiller, he was expected to take over the windmilling business. And that was, his family just really thought he was pretty crazy to not want to do that.
Well, it's alternative energy now.
That's right, yeah. Mm.
So did he also come to Auckland?
So he came to New Zealand to work for 2 years in a cheese factory.
And I thought he's Dutch, so he must do cheese.
Well, it's not quite like that. He saw the advertisement that New Zealand was looking for cheese makers, and he thought, New Zealand, that's a long way from Holland. I want to go to New Zealand. And so he did a cheesemaker's course in order to get this passage, this return passage, and to work in New Zealand for 2 years, because he didn't come here with the intention of staying here. He came here to see more of the world. So he came as a cheesemaker, made cheese at night in the Penrose Milk Factory, and by day he carried on completing the degree he'd started at Rotterdam University. He completed that at Auckland University, and while he was there, he met my mother, who was
Auckland. And what was she studying?
She was doing a degree in... Well, she was doing a BA.
Right.
In ancient English and German, and she went on to become a primary school teacher. And then a mum, but she could have this education, you know, for her family, getting an education was so important.
Absolutely, and so both sides of your family then were intellectuals.
Well, they were university educated, but not. I wouldn't describe them as intellectuals. No, I mean, my dad's a really practical person, but he really wanted
to... You can't
do
both.
Absolutely, you can do both. You can be an intellect and you can be sporty. You can, you don't have to be pigeonholed, do you?
So they got married in Auckland. They met at university and they remained in Mount Albert.
Well, they went to... There's a family that came out from Vienna. One family listened to my grandfather when he said, you've got to get out of Vienna. You know, something terrible is going to happen. I know, just judging from history, there's going to be a lot of Zurichs. And only one family agreed. Everybody else said, oh, but we're Austrians first and Jews second. And the family that listened and came out with them was the Hirschfeld family, and they settled in Wellington. And Ziggy Hirschfeld started the Metal Import Company. And their younger son, Michael, was president of the New Zealand Labour Party for some years until his untimely death at the age of 50. And their older son, Ali, became a negotiator. He made Aliyah and became a negotiator between the Palestinians and the Jews over all the years of all the troubles since Israel became a nation. I can't remember where I was going with that.
So you were talking about, your family lived in Mount Albert still?
So that's right. So the Hirschfeld family came out, and when my father completed his, or even before I think he completed his degree, Ziggy Hirschfeld offered my dad a job in his company, you know, on the management side, because he was doing a BCom. And my father worked for the Hirschfelds and the Metal Import Company for many, many, many years.
So that's what happened in those days when families helped each other, supported each other, because the horrors behind them brought it out that that's the only way you can survive is by helping and supporting each other.
Mm. And even though Gizzy and Ziggy lived in Wellington and we were in Auckland, they were like my other set of grandparents, because, of course, my second set of grandparents were in Holland and Veenendaal. So Gizzy and Ziggy were like our other grandparents. So it's like I had two sets of Jewish grandparents, even though I'm only half Jewish.
And so you were born and brought up?
Yes.
In Mount Albert?
Well, my parents built a house in Henderson when it was just a little village, sort of Henderson Valley. They grew wine. It's not a great place for growing wine, you know, it's because of the fungus in that area. Right. There's not a lot of wind movement. But my parents bought a bit of land out in Henderson, and I went to Henderson Kindergarten, Henderson Primary, Henderson Intermediate and Henderson High, and I now work at Waitakere College. So right. I've sort of made this big circle around the world and come back to where I started.
So you're a Westie then?
I'm a Westie.
So then you went to Henderson High and you decided to have a profession. So what profession did you choose?
I loved science. Science was my favourite subject at school. And if I couldn't see it down a microscope, I wasn't that interested. So I left school at the end of year 12, Form 6, and I started work in the medical laboratories at Green Lane Hospital. But I discovered that the eyesight issue, which I'd always known I had, in terms of being a medical laboratory technologist, was a physical handicap. At school, we had single-lens microscopes, and in the hospital, we had double-lens microscopes. And I have amblyopia, so I have a lazy eye, which means I see mainly out of one eye, but sometimes the other eye takes over and I see out of that one. And so I was trying to do white cell counts, and one eye would start. It was just impossible. So I had to leave. I couldn't do that work, and I had no idea what I wanted to do, you know. If I couldn't see it down a microscope, I didn't want to know. So that was 1973, and then the Yom Kippur War started. So I'd actually lived, my family went back and lived in Holland and Israel and travelled around Europe for a total of 18
your
months.
Your family being your mother and father?
My mother and father and my two younger sisters and I. Mm-hmm. So we lived in Europe and Israel for 18 months after I finished intermediate school. So when the Yom Kippur War started, I was thinking about all the, you know, the kids I went to school with in Israel and family and
did you go on a kibbutz or in the
state? Yes, we lived on kibbutz Lehavot HaBashan in the Upper Galilee with family members. And my sisters and I went to school. My mum worked in the laundry. My father worked in the pardes, the orchard.
So as a Dutchman, he fitted in quite well.
Yes. And we loved it there, but, you know, it was never the plan to stay there. Mm. the plan was to visit Israel, because my mum was actually going to make Aliyah when she met my dad. She had been in the process of making Aliyah, and then she met Dad, and all those plans got put on hold. So she could go, and it was a something we did for mum, so she could go and stay in Israel. And of course, we all went with her.
Oh, yeah, lovely!
Yeah. So after the Yom Kippur War, I put my name down as a volunteer to go back to Israel. Oh. As a volunteer, and this time I was sent to kibbutz in Harod Meuchad in the Beit Shean Valley. And
so you went back as a volunteer?
I went back as a volunteer.
Not with any youth group?
No, just
by yourself.
As an individual.
Yeah.
Yep. And I, because I spoke Hebrew, they let me work with the children, but I didn't always do that. I mean, you get put on whatever job needs to be done. Mm. And at the end of the 6 months, when the visa expired, I just came back to New Zealand and I thought, oh, I've got to really do something. I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I enrolled at university to give myself time to think about what career I wanted. And I did 2 years full-time, and then I thought, I really need some money. I was teaching Hebrew and I was, you know, working in an office doing a little bit of stuff, but you know, because I didn't go to the seventh form, I didn't have a bursary, although I won one after the results of my first year at university, but it was still tough. So then I enrolled at Teachers College because I had enjoyed working with the children in the children's house, and a lot of people said, oh, I should be a teacher. So I thought, oh, maybe they're right. So I took myself off to Teachers College in Epsom and trained as a teacher. And continued working on my degree while I was there. I did the two-year program. Mm. And then I won a scholarship to go back to university and complete my degree. So I thought, right, I'll do that. Then I won't have it hanging over me while I'm teaching. So I did that, and then I...
So you did a degree in teaching?
No. There were no... The Bachelor of Teaching didn't exist yet.
Right.
I actually wanted to be a psychologist. If I couldn't be a medical technologist, I thought, oh, psychology, that sounds interesting.
So instead of going through looking at thing, you look into people's neshamas.
Yes, exactly. but in those days, the psychology department at Auckland University was in great disarray. Prof Sampson had a much too great a relationship with the bottle than was good for him, and he'd roll up to lectures 9 o'clock in the morning, and if you sat in the first few rows you could smell what he'd eaten for drunk for breakfast. Mm-hmm. And it just I didn't want to carry on, you know, studying in a department that was in such disarray. So then I moved to the education department, and which in those days was under the guidance of Professor Mari Clay, and she was marvellous, and the work that she did still impacts how we teach children to read today. But unfortunately, Professor Clay was ill quite a lot in those days, and that department was struggling. You know, you'd have to do a prerequisite to do another paper, and that prerequisite wasn't going to be held that year, and it just became impossible to put together a program. So I ended up studying anthropology because all the papers were available, and the staff were really dedicated, and
they were there.
They were there, and it meant I could complete my whole degree in one year. I had to find a way to complete it. But, you know, for the work I do now, having a background in anthropology is actually
useful.
It's really useful. And so my psychology papers have helped, my education papers have helped. I did Māori studies. Back then, it wasn't the popular subject it is today. I did Māori language and Māori culture, and so all of that's all come together. And actually,
and the outcome was
so I taught for 2 years, and I actually miscarried my first three children. Mm. And as a result of that, and linking up with a woman that I'd taught with who just had a miscarriage, we started the miscarriage support group, which we later had to change the name to Miscarriage Support Auckland, because 12 other groups started around New Zealand. And that's where I met you first, Joan, trying to get COGS funding for Miscarriage Support Group. And my boss at Miscarriage Support suggested that I train either as a counsellor or in non-for-profit management, something like that. So I chose counselling because, you know, that fitted really nicely with my interest in psychology. And I came here to Unitech, and I did the grad dip counselling that in narrative therapy, which...
And then you found yourself there.
Did I find myself? Oh, I think finding oneself is a lifelong process. Do we ever complete it?
If you find a profession that gives you joy, that gives you satisfaction, that keeps on challenging you, that's what I call finding yourself.
Well, I think I have the best job in the world, working with young people and helping them with the issues.
So these are students that you're working with, or youth groups?
No, I work with the students at Waitakere College. I'm head of guidance at Waitakere College. It's a school of about 1,400 students, Decile 3 school in West Auckland, and poverty exacerbates everything.
They've had a history at Waitakere College,
Some of them have had really difficult lives, and they turn out to be the most awesome adults. Those kids are amazing, and the teachers at Waitakere College are just awesome as well. So they get a lot of support.
Because if the kids don't get that support, they'll end up with the Department of Vulnerable Children, and that ain't good.
Well, and of course, that is usually because of problems going on for the parents.
Absolutely.
Things they're struggling with.
So when you do counselling with the children, do you speak to the parents as well, or you only focus on the children?
Well, I can work with the families. I love doing family therapy. But, of course, the school student is my client, and it's up to them whether or not they want a parent or both parents, whatever, to come into the counselling process. They have the same rights as a counselling client. Anywhere out there, you know, seeing any adult seeing somebody in private practice or through an agency, the school students have the same rights. I have to work to the same code of ethics, and it's they are the client, and they decide whether or not they want their parents to be present. They might ask me what I think, you know, and I can give an opinion, but you know, I can in a way, you can work with the whole family, even if they're not present.
Yeah.
You know? I'm in narrative therapy, we do something called remembering practices, which is bringing someone else into the room with you. Someone who's not physically present. Yes, it could be someone who's passed away or a parent who's not physically in the room, or a beloved grandparent or whatever. And, you know, the young person who's my client can talk about, so what advice do you think your grandfather would give you in this situation? Because, of course, they know their grandfather. And whatever problem they're struggling with, you know, we can ask, what would grandfather
ask? Are they from different cultures? So it is a multicultural.
Waitakere College has the ethnic composition that most closely matches the ethnic composition of the whole country.
So that's really interesting, because you have to tailor your approaches, taking the cultural aspect into consideration.
Well, that's where narrative therapy is so brilliant. It's the therapy that works best cross-culturally, because unlike other kinds of therapy, person-centred therapy, Rogerian therapy, where the counsellor has to be the expert, in narrative therapy we look at our clients as the experts. They're telling the story of the life that they're the expert in.
Of what's affecting them. But they expect an outcome.
Yes. But they need to make decisions about what's going to work for them within the context of their life.
And does this seem to go on, or do they come to a stage when they say, we don't need you anymore?
So one of the things about narrative therapy is it comes to a good conclusion very quickly. It's amazing. 4, 5, 6 sessions, as opposed to older styles of counselling where people are sometimes in therapy for months,
for years.
Years. That's right. Narrative therapy usually works after... you know, has reached its conclusion with very few sessions.
And then do they ever come back?
Yeah, sometimes.
Or they said, well, things have now okay, so we don't need you anymore and we don't
Well, you know, sometimes I might have counselling. Let's say a grandparent has passed away, and we're doing grief work, right. And then there might be another situation. You know, next year, a boyfriend or girlfriend might break up with them, and then they've got something else they want to work on. So,
do you have much bullying? Students talking about bullying.
Bullying is a very big topic at the moment. We actually have very little at Waitakere College. Of course. We have the same amount as other schools, but we're very, very good. You know, the deputy principals and the deans are very, very good at dealing with it. And so it's a school where it's safe to come and tell teachers that they're, for students to come and tell teachers that they're being bullied. So that means we can work on it.
And especially if it's done on social media?
Including everything, yeah.
How many counsellors do you have?
1.8. We've just gone up from 1.6 to 1.8.
What does that mean?
So I work full-time, and we have a male counsellor who works 4 days a week. So we couldn't possibly get through all the work with that staffing level. So I also have interns. I've got 3 interns at the moment. So
university.
Those are people studying counselling who haven't completed their qualifications yet, but they have to have a placement as part of their learning so they can practice what they're studying. And they have to do 200 hours.
So does the culture, you know, the different cultures they come from, is that a problem at all, or do they all have, you know, take it for granted?
Well, I think, you know, for the young people, they make friends with people of all different cultures. You know, you see girls in hijabs walking around arm in arm with, you know, Pacific Island girls and Pākehā girls, and everybody makes friends with each other. Of course, you know, in the counselling session, I do ask about their culture and their family and what part it plays in their life to get an understanding of how it might be or not be impacting on the situation they're dealing with.
Well, sometimes that at home they need to have a certain conduct.
That's right.
Which can impact them, or they can discard when they come back.
And of course, young people from a non-Pākehā culture, they're dealing with their culture of origin, they're dealing with the Pākehā culture in New Zealand, they're often being participating in Māori events in the school as well. So, you know, they're trying to keep their balance. I say, you know, you've got one foot on each waka and each waka is moving independently in the water and you're trying to keep your balance. I mean, they're doing all of that as well as learning, as well as having boyfriend and girlfriend breakups and grandparents pass away, you know. So it's just an extra layer of trickiness in their life.
Well, you seem to be doing a fantastic job, and it's really been most interesting. I'd love to know more about what you do and what sort of problems young people do have. So we'll just have to have another session.
Okay, you're very welcome.
So thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10:10. And if you've missed this program, you can go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom, one word. And we would like to thank most sincerely our sponsor, Nature Bee.
Let's do this thing. Come on.